The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Please welcome Adrian Tomina.
Hi. Let's see. thanks for coming out tonight. I was just remembering that I do have a request, a bit of business. My friend Peggy Burns, who's been setting up all these events, every time I talk to her on the phone, she says, make sure you bring your camera and take a picture of the event and the venue. She's at home on maternity leave, so she couldn't come along. And I've done, I think, 4 events now, and I've forgotten to bring my camera every single time. So if anyone has a little camera and can take just a picture of the space or something and send it to her, you'll let me off the hook a little bit. Let's see. Let me make sure this is set up. Okay. Let's see. I think I'm going to start out by talking about one of the strangest things that happened to me when I first started working in a professional way and having my work published was I started doing things like this, or starting to doing interviews or meeting people who had read my work. And one of the things that surprised me the most that kept coming up was the whole idea of my own heritage, my own ethnic background. And a lot of times I'd talk to these journalists who were almost disappointed with the fact that I was not using every comic that I did to address issues of race. And and this is something that started happening like 15 years ago and has continued up through interviews that I've been doing this week. And one of the strange accusations that comes up is that I've actually been consciously disguising my own background for some reason, for maybe to get ahead in this, you know, notoriously bigoted business or something. and as proof of this theory, they always they show me this, which is me without my eyes visible, they're convinced that that's me disguising my actual appearance and my heritage. Like I said, I was taken aback the first time I heard of this, and you know, I think this is a good chance to show exactly what was going on. It was really nothing like that. I mean, I can't think of any reason why I would come up with such a strange plan. But I was actually really just following in a tradition of cartooning that I'm sure most of you are familiar with. But I went back and looked through a lot of the comics that I was reading when I was basically learning how to do what I do now. And these are just a few of the examples. There's Chester Brown, there's Seth, there's Joe Matt, there's Robert Crumb, and there's even Marcy, who was, you know, Peanuts, probably the first influence in terms of comics that I ever had, and really one of the few things that I actually love more, you know, at this point in my life than at the start of it. I guess I'll just be brief here, but I think maybe to those critics who thought I was, you know, trying to hide something, I could have possibly looked to another cartoonist for inspiration, and that would be our beloved cartoonist Milton Caniff, who created this strip in 1942. And this was a strange, this is a little digression, but this, imagine, you know, going on eBay thinking like, oh, I'd like to find some rare books by this cartoonist that I really love, and then finding this, so I naturally had to buy it. It's a low blow. I mean, he's not here to defend himself, and this was a long time ago. But since we have it here, we should take a look at a few of we can learn a little bit from Milton Caniff. That he has a code here. C is Chinese and J is Japanese. You can see in the second panel that C is dull bronze in color, while J is lighter, more on the lemon yellow side. C's eyes are set like any European or Americans, but have a marked squint. Jay has eyes slanted towards his nose. it just goes on and on. This is the last part was the weirdest one to me. He said, according to Milton Caniff, to sum it up, spotting a Jap depends upon three things. One, appearance. Two, feet. And you can see in the previous one the difference between feet. And three, pronunciation. But if you notice also, in that last panel, among the qualities that he's singling out as identifying a Jap is the G string. It's the second to the last one, which raises some questions about the circumstances of the determination here. But anyway, that's enough of that. I guess that brings me to this. I guess it was about 5 years ago when I started working on this book, and the title has many possible meanings, or at least two, as I've figured it out. But I think the one that doesn't come up is that I was sort of thinking about some of my own artistic shortcomings, things that I was unhappy with about my own work, and was trying to maybe address with this book. I felt like I'd finished the last story in what was going to be put out as my previous book, Summer Blonde, and I knew I was sort of having like a fresh start. Like I felt like this was a sort of a chance to at least think about some of the things that I was unhappy with about my work and had been. I felt like I'd been sort of on a roller coaster and didn't have a chance to stop and think about it for a while. And one of the first things that came to mind when I was starting to try and sort through all that was just the fact of how much my work has always just been really like the product of my influences, really like, I didn't have any formal training in this, and I didn't go to art school. The way I learned was just by, reading and enjoying and trying to copy the cartoonist whose work I admired. And, I think it taught me so much, and it really made me who I am now. But the downside to it is that all those influences are just quite apparent. And I think after 10 years or so of seeing reviews where it keeps being brought up, and it was just starting to really not annoy me, because I felt it was justified, but I was like, is there anything I can do to try and deal with this a little bit instead of just turning a blind eye to it? Excuse me. And, one of the things that annoys me when I read interviews with other cartoonists is when they try and deny their influences. I don't know why that seems so common now, but I thought this was a good chance to just to own up to some of them and talk about how they impacted me before I talk about how I tried to combat them. This is number one. I mean, this is the reason why I got into writing and drawing my own comics. It's a page from Love and Rockets by Jaime Hernandez. If anybody here is unfamiliar with my work, they probably think that it looks just like one of my own slides. It's like it's impossible now for me to draw a pretty woman and with solid black hair and it not look exactly like something Jaime would have drawn. And this is just, like I said, this was the thing that transitioned me from reading superhero comics into reading underground or alternative comics. And, there's a lot of obvious stylistic things that I've taken, but when I was putting together this presentation, I also realized how much I was just inspired by a page like this, where there's no action, there's no plot even, but it's two people sitting around talking, and everything comes down to the content, the dialogue, what they're saying, and their little facial expressions and gestures. And I don't think there's anyone who does it better than Jaime. And the second obvious influence on my work is this. This is Daniel Klaus. This is it's a page from Ghost World, and probably not as obvious influence visually as Jaime was on me, but in so many other ways, I think it was new to me to see such a strong personality brought into a comic. I was used to reading kind of production line comics as a kid, and it's hard to get one eccentric personality to push through a machine like that. And so to see something like this was another revelation. And again, when I was putting to this putting this presentation together, I realized that, again, it's a story that has virtually no action, no plot, and it's mostly about two characters sitting around talking. In trying to deal with this, I had this fantasy of just completely like reinventing myself, and with after Summer Blonde coming out with something that was just completely unlike anything I'd ever done before and didn't look like it had any antecedents in other people's work. And it didn't take me long to realize like that was just pretty much impossible, at least in terms of the visuals. I thought like there was no way for me to make it different and still good. Like I could, put the pen in my left hand or draw with my teeth or something, and it would be very different, and it wouldn't look like these guys, but it wouldn't be any good. So I just had to sort of come to terms with that, and that's something that I'm always going to have to struggle with, I think. But the one thing that I sort of latched onto was the idea of personalizing the content. Like I decided I wanted to come up with a story that was just based on observations and experiences and anecdotes, and I just wanted it all to be just a lot more specific to my own experience. And one of the rules that I set for myself was like, is this the kind of character that might show up in Dan or Jaime or Chris Ware or any of these guys who impacted me so much? Would this character or would this scene show up in one of their comics? And I tried to sort of gravitate towards things that wouldn't. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit. I don't want to bore people too much with the process, but I'm going to talk about just how I physically went about creating these pages. There was a period, I guess, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, where I really got invested in the idea of writing my comics, like almost like a script. It was like just very tediously, like sitting at a computer and in Microsoft Word and typing it out like a movie script, and then printing that out and then going to the drawing board and illustrating it in comics form, basically. And at some point, I read an interview, I think, or maybe I overheard this, but I heard the cartoonist Chris Ware talking about the idea of using comics as its own language, as opposed to sort of trying to mash writing and art together, but just thinking of it as its own language and writing in the form of comics. And I remembered, oh, yeah, that's how I used to make comics before I got so, self-conscious and so worried about being professional. I used to just sit there at the drawing board and kind of just make it up as I went along. And so I decided that with this book, instead of typing anything out on a computer in advance, that I would write it out in comics form. And this is like a first draft. That's what this is. I sat down with these weird engineer computation pads that I've for some reason latched onto and just a mechanical pencil. And that's, I just kind of started in the upper left-hand corner and worked my way down. You can see I tried to work as quickly as possible so it wouldn't be too slow of a process, and I knew there'd have to be revisions. So I think I have one intermediate. So that was the first attempt. And then, you can see then I pasted a whole new top tier. What is it? The positions of the people have changed. Oh, and actually revised a lot of the dialogue too. And then from there I took it to the finished piece, and that's how it saw print. Here's another page from later in the book. This is towards the end, and I'm trying to remember what I changed on this. Oh, yeah, this is, I don't know. I was getting down towards the end of the book. I could actually count the number of panels I had left until the very end of the book, so I was really working on this hard, trying to make every panel just mean something and have the right effect. I felt like, I didn't have a lot of space to waste in the whole book, but it was getting really crucial here. So I think I did the changes towards the end, and you see, can I point? What is this? Oh, yeah. So here you can see the Ben character. He's tapping on a door, and then we see, like, this is a weird panel. It's like it's almost from inside, and we see his face looking in, and then we see what he sees. I lost the pointer. Anyway, you see what he sees, which is his two friends in bed, and then there's a strange reaction on his face. A lot of people have asked me about how I decide when to move forward from each stage, and I can never really articulate what it is other than it's just something feels wrong, and I just have to keep bashing away at it until it seems right. And that's what I did here, and you can see that this is the revision. So he still taps on the door. I realized that panel of him looking in was irrelevant, that if you just show a little bit of – where is that? Okay. If you just show a little bit of the door here and then the view inside, it's sort of implicit that that's his point of view. And then I could move this one up by one panel, and that gave me the space to have this panel of him leaving his last message to them. And then there's the final page. I think, what else? Another one of the goals that I had with this book was to just adhere to a sense of realism as much as possible, to have everything seem believable and natural. And it became important to me to have this story exist in the real world, to have it take place in locations that I was familiar with. And it helped me to sort of write the story if I could in my mind envision where the characters were moving around from place to place. And so I decided I was going to be pretty specific in that regard. And so I'm going to just show some of the reference that I used in that regard. This is a Mexican restaurant in Berkeley, California that I used there. You can see I changed the name for some reason. As soon as I put out the first chapter of this, one of my cartoonist friends started kind of making fun of me for making these bizarre changes. Like, why did it have to go from Juan's place to Jose's place when it was obviously the same restaurant? But I don't know. Once I started, I couldn't stop, and I had to keep that consistent through the book. And I don't know. I think I was, like, arrogantly thinking that, like, there was going to be some legal concerns, that, like, I was such a big deal that Juan was going to come after me or something. I don't really think I needed to do that, but... And here's another one. This is a strange bar up in Oakland, California. And it's the exterior is the least strange thing about it, actually. If you're ever up there, you should definitely check it out. Now we're in Brooklyn. This is a Chinese restaurant that, in my mind, was the nearest decent Chinese restaurant to where Alice and Meredith lived. It's been completely remodeled since then, so now the story is already out of date. And this is in Soho in Manhattan. And, I think I was probably going a little too far with my specificity, but I needed for the plot, for Ben to be able to basically stalk that other couple and to be able to sit in a restaurant or in a cafe window and watch the front door to their apartment. And so I actually wandered around until I found a setup like that on Green Street. And so that's the building that's right across from a cafe with a big window that's perfect for stalking. And this is back in Brooklyn. This is O'Connor's. And again, it's a place that I was familiar with and I thought would make sense for the characters to hang out in. Oh, I guess this is one last one. This is up in Oakland. This is Mama's Royal Cafe and another eccentric place that seemed like the kind of place where Alice would hang out. Let's see here. Okay. Another thing about wanting to have this sort of realistic feel to the whole book was, and also another thing about trying to fix certain complaints I had about my own work, was that I went back and looked through a lot of my old stories and just realized how heavily I was relying on narration and those comic book thought bubbles. I realized that I was sort of leaning on them to give the readers almost like a fake access into characters' internal world, and I think it was sort of a cheap way for me to make people think, oh, it's so insightful or something. And I was just thinking, like, you know, that's not really how you experience, you know, conversations and people in real life, and especially in a story that has to do with some lies and deception and things like that. It would just be too weird to occasionally have direct access to a character's deepest, darkest thoughts. So I decided to just impose a rule on myself that there would be no narration, there would be no thought bubbles, and everything that you see has to basically be as you would experience it in real life. And what that did is that it sort of placed a new emphasis for me on facial expressions, gestures, just external things that might sort of give a little hint into what was going on internally for the characters. And, I think it was a good experiment for me, and it pushed me in certain ways, and I don't feel like I completely matched the, it doesn't quite have the same impact of reading a character's secret thoughts, but I hope it will, that somehow the visuals will express something more than just illustrate what the words are saying. So here's just a few quick examples of that. This is one that I worked on for a while, that the girl's face. It's I don't know if I quite got it, but it's this expression that I often make when I'm like in a very awkward situation or I feel like I've put my foot in my mouth or something like that. And this one works good on PowerPoint. It's almost like animation. This one. This is an example of something that wouldn't have come up if I was typing it out on a computer. This was something that just presented itself as I was sketching. So it's that, and then there's the reaction from Ben up in the office. And here's another one. This is a painful one. This is when Ben's going to make his big move, and you watch this very polite, peaceful face evolve into this, which is she's embarrassed for him. She wants him to shut up. I unfortunately have done some research to achieve these expressions. I just heard my wife laugh very loudly over there, so that's nice. This is a whole sequence that I think people, you just flip through really quickly in the book because there's not a lot of dialogue, but it is something that I worked pretty hard on, and I was embarrassingly enough almost kind of trying to stage it a little bit in my own studio and you know, make everything move right, and every little gesture had to be right in my mind. And I feel like, it's a silly scene, but I feel like there's a lot that can be inferred from some of the characters' expressions. And so there's this one, and then there's that. And then this, where the guy freezes in his kung fu position, and the girl is a little bit embarrassed or taken aback by it. And then to emphasize the agony of it, I pull back and give a shot that sort of makes it seem like it's lasting even longer. And then I have to give Ben a smart-ass response while the guy's still frozen in place. Let's see, another... Yeah, I guess I'll talk about this. When I was finishing up this book, and I felt like I'd spent 4 or 5 years on it, and I was just done with it, and my publisher called me up and said, "Oh, you got to design the book now. You got to give us the complete package with the dust jacket and all that." I went into a little bit of a panic. I just became so self-conscious and so worried about the fact that they were going to print a lot of copies of this, and I was going to have to go out and face the public, and I've never felt like I'm really a good designer. It doesn't seem like it's one of my strong suits, and it's not something that I particularly enjoy. And so I even started toying with the idea of calling up a friend of mine who is much better at this kind of work and asking him if I could pay him out of my own pocket to design the book for me. And eventually a few friends of mine talked me out of it, and they sort of said, like, well, the worst thing that would happen is if you hire your friend to do it and you hate what he comes up with, and then you're stuck with it. So you should at least, you know, it's worked out for you in the past. You should give it a try, and, whatever the result is, at least it was your doing. So that was, this is the dust jacket for the book. And I think that was a good lesson for me. I feel like, especially now that there's such an interest in publishing graphic novels, all these big book publishers are trying to sign up the latest graphic novel. I feel like this whole aspect of it is getting a bit lost in the shuffle, and I think that that design is certainly an element of cartooning. And when I finished this, I had the thought of, like, yeah, what if I had to just submit the guts of the book to a publisher and they packaged it up without my input, and just how frustrating that would be for me. So I definitely am now in favor of it, and I recommend that people think of it as part of the whole process. I mean, it's like you want to present your work the way you think it should be. Okay, I've just got a few more things to talk about here. I've been doing a lot of interviews and press for this book, and through no fault of the journalists, a lot of these similar questions keep coming up, and I've realized that for some reason that there's a lot of interest in trying to parse out how autobiographical this book is, you know, whether it's fictional, whether I'm the main character. I'm not sure what leads people to this line of questioning. I've tried to change my appearance a little bit to mislead people, but you know, that was something that didn't even really occur to me when I was writing the book too much, and it has been made clear to me in retrospect. But I think it's, you know, and I can understand the interest too. In a way, I just finished reading Philip Roth's new novel, and the whole time I kept asking these same questions in my mind that I get so annoyed with for journalists asking me about, like, you know, did that really happen to you? Is that you when Zuckerman says that? Is that you really saying that? And I was actually doing an interview, like an email interview, and I got to midway through, and the questions just started to be panel by panel through the book. Do you endorse or critique this opinion that this character says? And it was just a list of these things, and I just decided that I think that if I was to answer those questions honestly and clearly, that I'd end up turning the book into exactly the thing that I was hoping to avoid, that it would turn into, you know, me as a person getting up on a soapbox and trying to scream my opinions into people's face. And you know, so I think it's you know, I don't think it's that useful. I feel like reactions that people might have to the work, or discussions they might have with other people, would probably be more interesting than anything I could offer in that regard. I also think that it wasn't very clear in my mind what I was doing, but when I think about it, I think that I did things, weird things like this, like making the character look a little bit like me and throwing in some other personal details here and there, was that I think I sort of liked the experience of having done autobiographical stories in the past, where people just really, you know, they sort of take it for granted that I'm not lying to them, that they're gonna accept these things as truth. And so I wanted to have that feel. I wanted the book to have the feel of being truthful, of you know, being honest, and at the same time not really have the constraints of strict nonfiction. So I think I was trying to confuse the issue a little bit and make something that on the surface could seem like autobiography but was in fact a completely fictional story. All right, and I think I'll just finish up with one last thing. A little anecdote, actually. Not long ago, my wife and I went out to dinner in Brooklyn, and we went to a Japanese restaurant, and we sat down at a small table, and as is the case with many restaurants in Manhattan, they seat the tables way too close, and you're privy to every bit of conversation at the table next to you. And we sat down, and literally the moment that I opened my menu, there was a couple at the table next to us, a young woman and a young man, and as I opened my menu, I overhear the woman say, "So, did you read that book I gave you, Summer Blonde?" And I lock eyes with my wife, and I'm like, what's going on? I can't believe this. And we're just frozen there. We're like pretending to read our menu, but we're like just frozen, listening to this. And the guy says, yes, he had read it, and then proceeded to launch into the most articulate, cogent, thoughtful, and devastatingly brutal criticism of my work that I've ever heard. I mean, this guy was—he must be a professor of literature or something. He was so well spoken, and so so vehement, and so earnest in his opinions. And he was saying things that were, on one hand, just so hurtful, but also I was just like, oh yeah, he does have a point. That I do. That does bother me. We were just frozen, and we were just unable to order, and we were listening to this escalate. It was turning into a bit of an argument between the woman and the man, and she was getting defensive, and she said, like, well, I don't know, I think there's a certain, like, nice poetic quality to some of the stories, and this set the guy off so insanely. He started going, like, oh, that's the worst thing about it. It pretends to be poetic, but it's just bullshit. It's not about anything. You're falling for his bullshit, you know? And so my wife couldn't take it anymore, and so she asked the waitress if we could be moved. And we moved to another seat at the sushi bar. Unfortunately, due to the acoustics of the restaurant, we could still hear the man's voice when it became gripped with more emotion. So it would fall silent, and then over the din of the restaurant, we'd hear like, oh, no, that was the worst story. That was the absolute worst one, and I'll tell you why. So it was an unusual meal, and they finished their meal before us, and when they got up to leave, I had to physically restrain my wife from confronting them, and she wanted to give them a piece of her mind, and she was quite incensed by the whole experience, and I think she was a little surprised that I wasn't as offended. It was weird to me, but I wasn't angry in the way that she was. And, I think that, for one thing, I realized that since pretty much like the first time I sent out a cheap little Xerox mini comic out to a few people, when I was a teenager, I've for some reason always received a really bizarrely polarized response to my work, like very extreme in the positive and negative direction. Like I said, I was like 16 years old and just selling these little cheap things that I made at Kinko's and getting like hate mail from people telling me I sucked and I need to give it up. And then, then on the other extreme, people just saying things that were just way too flattering. And had it just been one or the other, I would have taken it to be the absolute truth. And if anyone's read the letters column in my comic, you'll see that this has continued for many years. And I think it's one of the nicest things that's happened to me in a way in terms of interacting with the readership, because it's sort of, like I said, prevented me from like believing too strongly in either direction and sort of taking each one with a grain of salt, but also trying to, take each bit of praise or criticism seriously. So like watching that couple have that argument almost felt like just like a microcosm of the response that I've always experienced. And I know that, some people think of me as a negative person or a cynical person, but I think on the positive side, I think one of the things that experience made me realize was that this is like a totally different era for comics than it was even 5 years ago. I mean, I was thinking that, 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, it would be so rare to see, an intelligent, beautiful, smart young woman trying to push a comic book onto her idiotic, thick-headed boyfriend. That was an unusual thing to witness. The fact that also he didn't dismiss it out of hand. I mean, he wasn't like, just a comic book, shut up about it. It's like he wanted to really give his informed opinion about what was bad about it. And, that's, again, a new level of respect for comics. And also just the fact that even if that exchange were to happen in the past, I mean, it certainly wouldn't happen in public. I think it wasn't long ago that, it was more socially acceptable for adults to talk about pornography or something than comic books. It was like such a embarrassing thing to talk about or to be a fan of. I while it was, slightly hurtful to me on a personal level, I thought like this is a really good sign that it's like a good time for comics, that things have changed for the better, and that it just I felt like I'm lucky to be trying to make a go at it in this time. And I think that's all the prepared material I have, but I'd like to open it up to questions if anyone has anything. I think we have to wait for people with microphones too, if anyone. I think there's someone there. They're recording it.
Sure.
I was just curious as to maybe what some of your favorite films are, because I've been noticing in a lot of your work it's almost cinematic in the way that it cuts from block to block, and I was just curious, do you watch many films that, like Clow's work or whatever?
I don't know if I would say that, I'll try to, I feel like a politician these days where I'm always trying to like, deflect the specific question and go into something else. So I'll try not to do that. But I will say that I don't know if I rely too heavily on film as a direct inspiration. It's not like I, watch a certain movie and then try and emulate that specifically in comics form. I've always said that comics have been my strongest influence in general. But I'm trying to think what possibly could have had an impact on this book. I know this is an unpopular one, and my wife is going to yell at me about this, but there were definitely some Woody Allen movies that I had watched over the years, and particularly the more serious, dramatic ones. I feel weird getting too specific because I feel like the filmmakers that I admire are just like, they're genius artists. And so if I say like, oh yeah, I was really trying to work in the mode of Stanley Kubrick or something, it's, you know, it's embarrassing to me. There are certain directors that I like, and Stanley Kubrick would be one. I think I think Adaptation came out while I was working on this book, and that had a big impact on me.
I know you were talking about the inner narrative dialogue that's going on, like little thought bubbles, and there's that line in Adaptation where voiceover narration is just monkey talk.
Right.
Did that jolt you to not go in that direction anymore?
I'd already kind of set the ground rules for myself at that point, but it's not like some one-way street that I've set myself on stylistically. The thing that I got to work on immediately after finishing Shortcomings had all the things that I had ruled out for Shortcomings. So it was in full color, and there's narration, and there's thought bubbles, and there's, you know, big sound effects. And when a car drives by, there's like a cartoon puff of smoke behind it. I think there's certain rules that I made specifically for this story for whatever reason, but it's not anything that I feel like I should impose on anyone else or certainly not on my future projects. There's someone there.
Moving from California to New York, what's the most surprising thing about New York?
The humidity. I didn't have to think about that long. I've spent my whole life living in very nice, dry climates where the seasons don't really change very much. And so to suddenly be confronted with Bristol board that I draw on, like, curling up as if it's possessed, and drafting tape ripping off the drawing table, and putting a rapidograph pen to the paper and watching the line just bleed out like it was going into water. That's a new experience for me. I'm trying to think what else.
Is there something particular about New Yorkers that?
I spend a lot of time alone in my studio. So to make some sweeping statement about the people, I don't know if I could do that. I don't know. I think that right now New York is still new enough to me that I feel like a tourist there. And every few weeks I turn some corner and recognize some scene from a movie or from a book or something, and I'm, you know, like, I want to get out my camera even though I live there. I don't know why I need to take a picture of it. So I don't feel like I have like a really objective view of the two places. There was a period where I was going back and forth between the two spots, and that was sort of difficult because it's natural to start to try and make comparisons, and like you're doing, you want to sort of, it's almost like trying to figure out which is best. And that was always a lot of trouble. And I've never come down on one side of the argument. As soon as I am complaining about the humidity in New York, then I'll go eat a burrito in Manhattan and pay $15 for something that resembles a burrito. And then the opposite will happen when I'll go back to Berkeley. Look how dry it is. And then like a shaved headed guy with a goatee will go by on a unicycle juggling, you know, and that's not even made up. I mean, that guy lives in my old neighborhood in Berkeley. I don't know. I'm sorry. That's not a very good answer, but that's all I can think of. Is there anybody else right there?
I was really interested by what you were saying about kind of trying to take out those thought bubbles and create something more real and kind of get out of that kind of comic convention. I was wondering if there was anything else frustrating about the medium that you wish you could break out of, or that instead is kind of liberating in that sense to create better reality in a sense.
Yeah, well, first of all, I should say that I don't think that any of those comic book conventions in any way necessarily detract from the realism of a book. I mean, there's plenty of great cartoonists. I mean, to go back to what I was saying, I think of Peanuts as one of the most real and human, you know, works of art, and it's the most simple and cartoony of all of them. This was more of just like my own guidelines for how I wanted to work, and it sort of was useful mainly to me to sort of set some boundaries for myself and sort of feel constrained by that and have to kind of work within those constraints and sort of compensate in other areas. But to answer more specifically about, I guess, what did you say, like things that I feel frustrated with about the medium or something?
I wonder if there's anything else that you might find artificial about comics, or that instead kind of like these limits that you're imposing on yourself that you might find maybe is too free. And
I don't want to say that there's that these things are artificial or anything, but in terms of frustrations that I have, I think one of the biggest ones is that the disconnect between, at least for this story that I was working on, the disconnect between the amount of time it takes to create the work and tell the story versus, you know, just the very slight amount of time that I'm trying to depict within the story. I mean, it was so weird to go through five of the most probably dramatic years of my life and have so much change about my personal circumstances. And then, you know, in the midst of that going on, then to have to every night sit down at my drawing board and be like, oh, now he's sipped the coffee out of the cup and now he set the cup down. And so that tends to give you that feeling of like, you know, your life ticking away, you know, passing before you as you're sitting there at that board. So that's something that I'm interested in with my future projects, about trying to create something that is still readable and still aesthetically pleasing, but is not so, you know, I guess anal retentive is one of the descriptions that my work has been given. Because, you know, I'm not that old yet, but it starts to get to the point where you think like, well, this took 5 years, and that friend of mine, he spent, you know, 7 years on a book, and you get out the calendar and think like, oh, you know, all the men in my family have died at this age. And, you know, you start, I mean, I'm not kidding. I know friends who have done this where they really have pared it down to like the number of, you know, two or three books that they're going to be able to complete before they die. I'm not kidding. And, so I definitely want to think about ways around that a little bit. Yeah, right there.
You spoke a little bit about your influences in terms mm-hmm. of comics. I'm wondering if there's any up and coming artists that catch your eye, somebody you can recommend.
Yeah, I think that, you know, going back to that little anecdote that I ended with, it's like this is truly an unusual period in the history of comics, and I think that there's probably been, you know, more new and more importantly, just more diverse talent coming into the medium in probably my, you know, as long as I've been a fan of alternative and underground comics, and so I was talking to some other cartoonist about this, how it's so so weird now to actually be in the position of like not feeling like you're on top of it at all. I mean, you know, it's like, and we're like real nerds. We go to the comic shop every Wednesday and we look at everything new that comes out, and there's still all these, there's so much new talent that we can't even like remember, like, you know, which guy is that? Is he the pencil-y guy, or is he the psychedelic guy? Or and you know, that's a great new experience to have. And I think that there's a few anthologies now that are really showcasing some of this kind of up and coming talent. And one of them is called Kramer's Ergot. It's a weird title, but it's, I don't know. It's sort of like the thing that's introduced me to so many new ways of approaching cartooning. And, you know, it's not always stuff that I would say I like. It's not like, oh, you know, this is my favorite artist, or I want to hang this art on my wall, or I got to go out and buy more of his stuff. But just to have that experience of being like, what is this? You know, what is this guy's influence? I mean, there was such a long period where where, you know, any new artist that came up was a lot like me. It was sort of like, oh, okay, I see he was into these five guys and he's mixed them together in this obvious way. And now you see these guys coming up who, you know, maybe they weren't even into comics and now they're trying it out. Or I know there's a whole school of guys who do really, you know, in my mind, avant-garde work, and I found out that all they like is like Image comics. You know, they actually follow these superhero comics, and that's what they like. And specifically, let me think. The guy who edits Kramer's Urgot is named Sammy Harkham, and he's a cartoonist himself who I think has already done great work. I hate to slight these people by saying they're like up and comers because they've accomplished. You know, a lot of them have more pages to their name than I do. Just off the top of my head, I think Vanessa Davis is a really great new talent. I don't know if anyone's familiar with her work, but she had a book that came out about maybe a year ago called Spaniel Rage, and it's kind of like it really is like her sketchbook diaries that have been published, and her work has that quality to me that has been people talk about Nancy as being like more trouble not to read than it is to read. Like when you see a Nancy strip, like to avert your eyes and not get the little joke is more effort than to just read it and get the joke. And her work has that quality for me where it's like if I open an anthology and there's a few pages by her, I just I can't help but instantly read it first. I don't want to bore you, but Jonathan Bennett and Tim Hensley are also two. They're not like kids. I mean, I don't want to slight their accomplishments. They've done a lot of great work, but I would definitely recommend them as someone to seek out for new talent. Is there anybody else? Way in the back there.
What do you see? Web comics and just the internet in general affecting underground comics and just the entire industry. You know, web comics, I mean, you can basically look at them for free. And does that seem like, does that take away from the business aspect of it? I mean, what do you think of that?
That's a big can of worms. I hate to sound like an old fuddy-duddy at the age of 33, but I'm not really into web comics that much. I mean, I know that there's. I think I'm unfairly judging it by the presentation of it more than the content. You know, that's no way to judge art. You don't want to say like I'm opposed to framed paintings or something like that. And that's probably what I'm doing. And I think that if someone could present me with the kind of artist that I like, and it's only available on the internet, then I'd have to go for it, like I said, it's probably just a generational thing. I think that anyone even slightly younger or more up to date than I am has no problem just transitioning from reading on a page to reading on the screen. And for me, there's a big gap there. And just in general, I've always preferred things on paper, and it'd be really hard for me if someone were to say that printed comics are completely extinct and the only way you can work is on a computer screen. I mean, that would be a tough choice for me to make. In terms of the business, I mean, there's so many ways that can go. I mean, this is the kind of thing that's being discussed endlessly in the music industry, I know. And it's annoying to me, like that people have told me that they come up to signings and they say, "I didn't bring your book to sign because I just got it off BitTorrent or something like that," and I didn't even know what that was. But then my publisher explained to me, like, "Oh yeah, everything you've ever done is just for free on these illegal sites, and there's nothing we can do about it." So to me, that is annoying, not because I feel like there's 5 cents missing out of my bank account now or anything. But just because I feel like I said, it was important for me to design the dust jacket to my book, and it's a control freak thing. I want to control the way that people receive my work, and if someone is scanning it at anything less than 12,000 DPI or whatever it is, and printing it out on their inkjet printer, I mean that's discouraging to me. I don't feel like that's the real version of what I worked on. So I think there's a lot of other ways that, I could approach that, but those are the things that come to mind immediately. Another one in the middle, sorry.
I know you've done some editorial work also. Do you want to talk about how you got those jobs, if they just came along to you or if you sought them out, like your New Yorker covers or anything like that?
Okay, you're talking about the illustration stuff that I do. I didn't ever set out. I had no ambitions as a child of growing up to be an illustrator. And I think the whole ball got rolling just when I started publishing my comics. It's sort of the whole magazine world is fairly small and friendly. And I think, the first commercial job I got as an illustrator was from Details, and they called the editor at Pulse magazine, where I was doing these little comic strips, and I did my first illustration, and then it just kind of went from there. And it was just one of those like nice bonuses that was suddenly presented to me, like, oh, here's a way that I can make a little bit of money by drawing. The New Yorker, that's like the main place where I do commercial work nowadays. That was the one job that I actually pursued. A lot of illustrators, it's like their Mount Everest or whatever. They aspire to it. And I was for a long time such a fan of the cartoonists who had worked for them, and especially, being in California, it's such a different world. You're so removed from the East Coast and from New York, and for me, getting a subscription copy of the New Yorker in the mail, like in Sacramento or in Berkeley, was like it's just like a message in a bottle from some other world. And it's like, I've never even heard of these movies, and what is all this stuff? So it always was important to me. And I can't even remember when it was when I started working for them, but this was obviously before I lived in New York, and I came out to visit a friend, and I did. It's a very old-fashioned thing, and I think even now, even since that time, it's been a little bit outmoded by the internet. But I brought my little pathetic portfolio of drawings and the few clippings that I had published, and I got out the phone book and found the number for the New Yorker and asked the receptionist where their offices were located, and went over there and was quickly told that it was the wrong day to submit drawings, but come back the next day. And so I just went through the process and left my portfolio there with this receptionist who was extremely intimidating to me. I probably have never felt more like a little hillbilly child or something. I felt like I didn't even know what I was doing, and I'd gotten in over my head. So that's just how that started. I left it there and went back to California, and eventually an art director there called me up and gave me my first assignment, and it's just sort of progressed since then from there. I've sort of gone off the track here, but were you also asking about sort of my experience with it, or my relation to that kind of work, or just how did I get started? Okay. What did you say? Oh, sure. Okay. Well, and then, I also have gotten in trouble in the past for being too flippant about my relation to the work. I actually had a book that came out a few years ago, publishing, kind of collecting some of that illustration work, and I probably made the mistake of referring to it as horror work. Several art directors have pulled that out and said, this was an interesting way to refer to all those jobs that I've given you over the years. It is sort of like this struggle where, for whatever reason, the jobs that pay the best are just. I almost feel like there's some evil puppet master who's controlling all this. Because any job that really offers the kind of money that it's like, it's really hard for me to turn down, or I even have to consider it, or I agree to it and get stuck with it, is just crushing. I mean, it is so demoralizing and. I've just been so fortunate and so like mollycoddled so far in terms of my professional work as working for Drawn and Quarterly, where I just have such autonomy and all that, to just be made so aware of the fact that you're just like this drawing machine, and that you need to do what you're told, otherwise you're going to be in trouble, is sort of a demoralizing experience. And so as much as possible, I try to avoid those kind of jobs. Oftentimes, they also require you to sort of I mean, I don't think anyone else thinks of it, but in my mind, I feel like it's asking me to implicitly endorse something. Like, it's usually advertising or something, and it's just really awful for me to then see the pictures of what I'm supposed to be, aggrandizing. That said, over the years, I have been able to develop a few really great relationships. One of them is with The New Yorker, and it's have such a great rapport with a couple of the people who work there that there's none of that that tension. There's none of that, like, that, you know, trying to smile your way through the phone conversation and then slamming the phone down angrily or anything like that. And so in cases like that, that's actually, like, something that I really look forward to. Like, if a span of time goes by where I haven't gotten a call from one of those art directors, I start to get really nervous, and I really look forward to my next chance to work for them. And it helps to be, you know, if it's in a source that I'm a fan of, or if it's, you know, in service of something that I actually do endorse. Is there anybody else? Right there.
What do you think about the current fad for, I guess, the graphic novel aesthetic in publishing? I've seen a lot of book covers recently that have sort of graphic novel type drawings on them, and, you know, sort of Chris Ware wannabes, and then you look at the illustrator and it's someone you'd never heard of who'd obviously just been given this assignment to copy someone, you know, a graphic novelist. Does it annoy you? Do you think it's good for the medium?
Well, I think the thing you're specifically talking about, this sort of poaching of some of the surface aesthetics, it does annoy me. And I mean, it annoys me especially when I see, jobs or money being given to someone other than, like you said, those guys who are getting ripped off so blatantly these days. I think, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but I'm sure it must mortify them to think of the idea of someone out there possibly mistaking that substandard work for theirs, like thinking like, oh, well, he really phoned it in on this one, you know? And I think that it is rampant, and it's so weird for me now that the idea of that weird phrase graphic novel, which is something that I never really latched onto, it's become so commonplace now. Like what was that horror movie that came out a few weeks ago? Like, what is it? It's like a vampire. 30 Days of Night. Yeah, it's like billboards all over that just say, based on the graphic novel. Like, that's like the biggest, like, never mind Josh Hartnett. Like, this is based on a graphic novel. You know, and the idea that means anything to anyone is kind of a mind blower to me. And I think, you know, there's so much positive that's come from this weird change where suddenly graphic novels are acceptable and are marketable and everything. There's so many good things that have come of it. But, it is also sort of worrisome when you start to sense that there might, for the first time ever, be a greater demand on the publishing end than there is a supply of good work. And it's like a complete reversal of how things used to be. I used to know so many great artists who just couldn't get their work out there. And now every mainstream book publisher, you know, is hoping to find their Fun Home or their Persepolis or whatever it might be. And I think the fear I have is that comics and this whole gold rush or something is gonna sort of wear out our welcome with the public in a way that the general interest amongst people can only be maintained with a supply of good work, and I hate the idea of someone, you know, on a lark going into a bookstore and instead of getting Mouse or Jimmy Corrigan or whatever it might be, picking up something that a book publisher had packaged, where they took like a failed Hollywood script and got an illustrator to turn it into comics, and you know, it's a piece of junk, you know. So that is something that concerns me. But, you know, I mean, there's nothing I can do about it. I think it's the best thing that someone with my limited power can do is to just sort of keep my nose to the grindstone and try and do the best that I can. You know, I can't stop the other stuff from coming out. Is there anybody else before we wrap up? Oh, sure. Yeah, right here in the front.
How to phrase this? Well, you said that you like being with Drawn and Quarterly because they give you this wonderful autonomy and you can do, you know, whatever kind of work you want to do. But with your most recent work, you limited yourself with I don't want to do any thought bubbles and narration. And I wonder what other kinds of limitations you enjoy putting on yourself to make your work more interesting.
That's a good question. Yeah, I think that you bring up one of the potential pitfalls of the in my mind, like the best comics publishers allow such freedom and such autonomy that it does run the risk of you know, an artist going insane and doing something terrible, and it just gets published anyway, and so there is that risk, and it is interesting that unlike pretty much any other commercial medium, for the most part, there is no editorial process, there's no back and forth, and there's no edits or suggestions even made. It's just, you know, in my experience, there have been times where my publisher reads the issue when it comes back from the printer. You know, I send a computer disc with the files on it straight to the printer, and they send him the books. So it is sort of an unusual situation that we're working in. And so I think maybe that is maybe on some level why I have been trying to impose certain restrictions upon myself, and sort of for the first time being a little more open to outside input before it finally goes to print. I used to think that was just you know, the complete opposite of how a alternative cartoonist should work, and now I'm actually seeing the benefits of that to some degree. And I'm trying to think what other specific limitations that I would put on myself in that regard. You know, I think, a real simple one is just color versus black and white. For many years now, my publisher has given me freedom to work in full color if I want to, and you know, that was sort of, I think at some point that would have been something that I would instantly have jumped on. And I think, for shortcomings that was a choice I made to not do that, for aesthetic reasons. And also for, like I said, it's sort of like when you strip down the number of tools at your disposal, you got to make the few that you have work that much harder. And, so I think that was another case like that. In a broader sense for future work, I think I'm trying to really, as much as possible, rule out, you know, subject matter or premises or storylines that I've already done in a way. I feel like there was sort of a temptation I have to fall back on a few certain themes and character types and just subject matter in general. And I think that, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be able to always improve in terms of quality, but I think that there's certainly a time now for me to make some noble failures if that's the result, you know. And that's and again, that's, you know, my publisher gives me no input. He doesn't say, you know, do a different kind of book. What's that?
They don't even make suggestions to you about where you've gone. I find that amazing.
No, my publisher is a very taciturn fellow, and he's told me that he learned very early on as a publisher that you can't, no matter what you say, you can't control the artist, and you can't go to their studio and force them to work faster or better or anything like that. You just either have to sign on with that artist and commit yourself to supporting them or not. And, you know, it's a very unusual business model that he has, but I think it served him really well. I think his real gift is in picking the artist that he wants to work with initially and just kind of having faith in what they're going to do. I mean, I know in my case, he definitely committed to publishing me way early. I mean, I feel like the sort of professional phase of my career happened, you know, really prematurely, and I sort of regret that. There's no way you can stop a 20-year-old from signing a contract with his favorite publisher that he's wanted to work for since he was a kid, but yeah, I think that, like, you know, I think that was sort of a risk that he took. Like, I know for a fact that he wasn't totally in love with what I was doing at the time. It wasn't exactly to his liking, but I think he wanted to make that investment. It's just how he works. Is there maybe one last one before we do the signing? Yeah, right there.
I got oh my God, I got really excited to hear you talk about Philip Roth, reading a Philip Roth plan on a book, and I'm sure you get really sick of talking about comics and drawing comics, and I was just wondering if you could talk about some other. I mean, I think of you primarily as a storyteller, you know, essentially. I think you're really phenomenally good at telling stories, and I wonder if there's other sources that you hold very dear to you or you're very interested in now, maybe something you read recently that was great, things besides comics that books or
I think it wasn't conscious, but it was conscious. Now I think that when I look back on my bookshelf, I realize that when I was working on Shortcomings that I was sort of making my way through a lot of the Philip Roth novels. And it wasn't like I was saying, I aspire to this or I'm going to try and emulate this. But I think that there were a lot of qualities that sort of about his work that maybe encouraged me to go in certain directions. Not that I would achieve anything like what he does with his novels. But, I think since the start of his career, I think he's really had a liberating effect on artists and authors. And I felt that a lot. I think... sorry to digress here, but I think one of the biggest changes for me with writing Shortcomings versus my previous work is I stopped really for the first time in 15 years being so deeply concerned about how the work was going to be received and how people were going to correlate that with me as a person. And I think that there was, I've said to someone else that, like, when I go back and look at some of my early work, I see like a very needy personality played out in these fictional stories, and I think I was trying to really make readers like me. I wanted them to like me as a person for some reason, I guess probably went back to like my time in high school where I couldn't interact with people on a normal social level, so I, you know, in my completely misguided logic thought, like, well, maybe if I do this sensitive comic, then girls will like me. And, you know, of course, I don't have to tell you how successful that was. But yeah, so that Philip Roth was on my mind, I think. I got to put the caveat out there and say that I'm not saying that, like, I aspire to this and now I'm like George Bush with the mission accomplished banner behind him or anything. These are things that I had in on my mind when I was working on this book. I think the something that I just kept going back to, and its influence is nowhere apparent in this work, but is the British version of The Office by Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant, which I know I was just on a plane the other day and it just blips by on the BBC channel and just looks so cheap and crappy and everything. But I really do think of it as like one of the great works of art that's been produced recently. And if there's anything that I could say that I took from that was just the idea of being able to find extreme pathos and humor and heartbreak in the most mundane of stories, you know, and also it's just a level of hilarity that I could only dream of aspiring to. I don't know what else. The question of music comes up a lot, but I don't think that was there's any really great correlation between music that I was listening to and the work that I did. I'm sorry, I'm sort of blanking out right now, but that's the best I can think of right now. Is there one last one, or should we just wrap this up and get out of here? Anybody else? Okay, all right. Well, thanks a lot for coming. I really appreciate it.
Folks, we'll have a book signing upstairs. Give us about 5 minutes to get up there. Thanks.
Yeah. All right, let me make sure I get this all shut off.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.